is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the European Union after terror attacks in the heart of Brussels. Where do we go from here? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On March 22nd, in the multicultural city of Brussels, home to the headquarters of the European Union and NATO, extremists linked to the so-called Islamic State, also known as Daesh, struck the airport and the city's metro system, leaving 32 people dead and more than 300 injured. The devastating bomb attacks show the Islamic State has opened a front in Europe as it loses territory in the Middle East. They also expose the weakness of Belgium's security services, but also the persistence and increasingly dangerous prospect of a sympathetic milieu for terrorist cells to form, hide, and operate in Europe. Attacks have set off a new round of soul-searching about the need for EU security services to redouble their efforts, improve intelligence sharing, even at the risk of further impinging on civil liberties. One thing is certain, Europe is facing an unprecedented security threat at a time when the Schengen system of open borders is in jeopardy due to the refugee crisis and, of course, terror attacks. Analysts say that the EU needs to reinvent its security system by breaking down the barriers that prevent vital information sharing. Other factors that exacerbate the EU security threat are the existence of marginalized Muslim communities, such as the Molenbeek neighborhood in Brussels, the presence of thousands of radicalized citizens who have traveled to fight the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and of course, the continuing Syrian conflict, which acts as an incubator and breeding ground for violent extremists. For more on the aftermath of the deadly Brussels attacks, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Benjamin Haddad is a research fellow in European and Transatlantic Affairs at the Hudson Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Leo Michel, he is a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome back to the program. First, let me turn to you, Benjamin, who has been on the show before. Many say that they weren't surprised about the attacks, many intelligence officials here in the United States and elsewhere. But again, we wonder what went wrong. To what extent is this a wake-up call for structural reform in terms of intelligence sharing and other matters?
I think the last time I was with you on this show was just after the attacks in Paris on November 13th. And already we were talking about wake-up call. And we were already talking about a wake-up call after the Charlie Hebdo and Hyper Cacher attack more than a year ago. It's true that a lot of the issues that were raised in the last few months, the last few years, at least since the start of the Syrian crisis and foreign fighters issue became a major security threat for the European continent, that these holes, I would say, in the security infrastructure of Europe, and especially when it comes to intelligence sharing and security coordination between countries, have been discussed, they've been pointed to, and yet, you know, we're still very far behind what needs to be done. I'll give you one specific example that's been raised in the debate these last 2 days is the passenger name record. It's a measure that's been discussed for a long time now at the European Parliament that would allow European countries to share information on people traveling using airplanes. It's not a silver bullet. It won't solve all the issues, but it's urgent to pass this thing. Most European countries now have this kind of bilateral sharing of information with the United States, but they don't have it among themselves. That's kind of striking when you think about it. So the security cooperation, for example, between France and the US is probably much more efficient than it is between France and Belgium. Now, also, you have some countries like Belgium that don't have a culture and expertise on security and intelligence matters that countries like France have, because France has been facing terrorism for a long time. There are already, for example, terrorist attack in the 80s from Hezbollah, from the 90s from Algerian radicals, in the mid-90s in Paris. So the scope of it is new for France. The threat is not something new. For Belgium, it's new. It's only the second terrorist attack against Belgium after the attack on the Jewish Museum in Brussels in 2014. So there's a lot to be done, and you raised some of the issues. The fact that Abdeslam has been able to to hide in the midst of Molenbeek for 4 months, which is exactly where everyone thought he was. So it comes as a surprise to no one, and yet no one tipped off the Belgian intelligence, the security services, and there's clearly major gaps in terms of security infrastructure in Europe that urgently need to be fixed. It's been said before, but I think these recent attacks just prove it once more.
Turning to you now, Leo Michel, for your take, whatever you have to add or subtract to these gaps, and of course this notion, and we found out recently when we spoke with General Michael Hayden, the former NSA CIA chief, said exactly what Benjamin said, that France and other European countries are more likely to share information with the United States than among each other. So will this change now as a result of these terrible attacks in Brussels?
Well, you mentioned the expression of a wake-up call, and I was working in the office of the Secretary of Defense on September 11th, 2001, and I was in the Pentagon at that time, and the European response was very positive, a lot of expressions of solidarity, and actually beyond what people know in the military field of the cooperation that ensued that eventually led to the operation in Afghanistan and so forth, the NATO operation. 2001 was also the beginning of a lot of new cooperation that simply hadn't been done in the 80s and 90s with the EU in terms of cooperation on counterterrorism, and it involved things already like exchanging information on passengers, on trade, because the volume of trade still between the US and Europe is so important. I think it's $5.5 trillion in commercial sales every year, so there's a lot that's going back and forth in containers and so forth. And that has been steadily improved, and that's the good news story since 2001. Even recently, there's a delegation from Europol that's here in Washington speaking to heads at our Department of Justice, our FBI and so forth, and Homeland Security. So there is an ongoing and increasingly dense relationship between the U.S. and Europe on a number of issues that involve counterterrorism. At the same time, I'm aware of General Hayden's remarks, and I worked a long time ago in the intelligence agencies. From what he said, I think that things haven't changed that much, that bilateral intelligence sharing is much easier for a lot of reasons and much more selective than it is dealing with large institutions. And I've heard this concern expressed by many European contacts that I have about the lack of full sharing within Europe. And that's more of a problem than perhaps at this time transatlantic sharing of intelligence. I would add, however, and I was in Europe 2 years ago in the aftermath of the Edward Snowden revelations, some of which were perhaps more accurate than others, and offered at the time at a public meeting that I didn't consider Snowden a hero because I was afraid that some of the long-term consequences, not only on the operational side, but on the political side, would be harmful to the necessary sharing that has to take place between the United States and Europe. I hear less of those concerns now, although Europe does have to weigh the important protections of privacy versus the important function that intelligence agencies have to serve.
Back to you, Benjamin Haddad. On that point, after Brussels now and after Paris, do you think now that these security concerns will outweigh these privacy concerns in Europe again? And it's not to undermine the importance of civil liberties, but I'm wondering if you think the EU will take notice and better coordinate among member states in terms of intelligence sharing now.
I certainly hope so. I think there was a missed opportunity just after the Paris attacks when François Hollande decided to invoke the Article 42.7 of the European Treaty, the Collective Security Article. It was an interesting move. It was the first time it was invoked. A lot of people expected him to ask for Article 5 of Collective Defense of NATO, but he chose the European approach. And it really said that for him, it was mostly a European challenge that concerned all European countries that demanded domestic measures, so beefing up security, intelligence, cooperation at every level, judiciary, police, intelligence, rather than just a, let's say, more traditional, conventional military approach that could have gone through NATO. And I think it's a missed opportunity because the French had a chance to really define what it meant to have collective security at the European level after this. There was a tremendous level of solidarity. I think there were some actually important steps if we want to see the glass half full, let's say a third full after this. For example, Germany sending troops to Sahel to relieve the pressure for the French military who was involved in Mali fighting Al-Qaeda. So there were good measures, but I think clearly it could have gone farther. As I said, you have a mix of maybe distrust between certain European countries when it comes to sharing intelligence. You have some countries that lag behind in terms of security cultures and experience. And just in general, it's very important to note that this threat has accelerated tremendously in the last 4 years. I mean, even for a country like France, as I said earlier, that has a history of fighting these terror movements. A friend of mine working for the French DCRI, which is the counter-terrorism intelligence agency, last week in Paris, was telling me that there were 40 French fighters who went to fight in Afghanistan in a decade. And in 4 years in Syria, it's about 1,500, even though the numbers vary. So it shows how suddenly this issue has accelerated. And for countries like Belgium that didn't even have the basic infrastructure to fight against these threats, it's even a much more considerable threat. To answer your privacy question, I think obviously it's been a concern in the United States after 9/11 with the debates around the Patriot Act, and it's exactly the debates we're having in Europe right now. As you know, for example, France is still in a state of emergency. It's been renewed. It is supported by the French population. It's a very fine balance for policymakers to still at the same time guarantee civil liberties, guarantee non-discrimination, and I would say just beyond the concrete measures, also guarantee a level of public conversation, a debate that stays responsible on these issues.
No question about it. Well, back to you, Lea Michel, for a brief answer with respect to creating a balance or finding the right balance between stepping up security, coordinating better, and at the same time respecting privacy rights. How do you see the Europeans getting this balance right in the aftermath of the Brussels attacks?
I think it's going to be a very long process. I'm struck by the fact that there is an important difference in the U.S. government when there are internal debates, and there are within the administration, between the administration and Congress, on finding this right balance. You have people who are in the room from both sides of the argument. I think it's sometimes not always the case in the European Union. The European Parliament has held off, for example, on ratification of this treaty that would have permitted the exchange of passenger name recognition data because of concerns about privacy. And that doesn't seem terribly well coordinated with what another part of the EU is doing, and that is the organizations are certainly EU-supported, like Europol, or even the broader common security and defense policy interests and mechanisms. It's not that the debate is easy in the United States. We know it isn't, and attitudes have changed over time. But at least you have all of the players in the same room doing the debate. And this is a little bit unusual that the EU would sign a treaty and then the parliament would feel somehow it was left out and refused to ratify it.
Well, Benjamin Haddad, before we go to a break, I've heard analysts say, you know, Europe has a common currency, but not a common European terrorism database.
It's absolutely true. You have a lot of instruments that work, but you don't have enough coordination. You don't have enough political decision-making abilities at the core of it to be able to make decisions. But the only other alternative is the alternative of dismantling what we have today and go back to national borders, go back to national policies, division, which will not solve the issue because terrorists will still find a way to be able to strike at the heart of our countries, but we will have less means and less resources to be able to fight it together. But I can tell you that having been in Europe just last week, I'm not sure it's going in the right direction. You know, for the first time in my adult life, taking the TALIS to go from Brussels to Paris, I had to go through a passport control. And it's a bizarre experience when you're a European who has been used to growing up without that.
You're referring to the Schengen open borders. And of course, Lea Michel, that's the other scary implication for Europe. A Europe which wants to have open borders now sees these terrorist threats. And of course, the migrant crisis just exacerbating the situation. There's a potential that borderless travel, the Schengen zone, is in jeopardy.
Yes, it's been a while ago, but in 1996, when I moved to Europe for an assignment for the Pentagon, I had to go pick up my car. I actually had an assignment in Geneva, Switzerland. I went to pick up my car in Antwerp. In the space of a day, I drove during 12 hours. I think I crossed 6 borders. My father was French, so it's very emotional crossing from Strasbourg into Kiel, and there's not even a policeman at the border, where you've had, you know, 3 important wars within 100 years. Once the new barriers are put in place, it's very, very hard to start taking them down. It sounds presumptuous to say what's good for Europe, but I think it's definitely not good for the United States. The United States has so many political and security interests. We have so many Americans who are in Europe, who are there for educational or tourism reasons, business people. We still have over 60,000 military plus dependents there. So U.S. security is very involved in what the Europeans can do to protect themselves.
And if indeed the United States has a better handle on how to coordinate because of our horrible attack here, 9/11, perhaps that's a good thing, and maybe the Europeans can learn something from how the United States does it.
Yes, and I would say not only in the security area. I was impressed by an intervention that was made, I think it was in February of this year, by our Deputy Secretary of State, who's Anthony Blinken. And he was recalling in a public speech where a little bit more than a year ago, there was a delegation that came from a Belgian city that had a circumstance similar to Molenbeek, where there was a large Muslim population and fear of radicalization and so forth. And there was the mayor and other officials from the city who came to see in the United States the way the Muslim population is integrated and so forth in certain programs that we have here. And he went back, and according to Deputy Secretary Blinken, that mayor contacted him recently and said, you know, they've had no incidents at all of radicalization in that community. So there is something. It's not that the United States has all of the answers. I would be the last to say that. But there are things that we can learn from each other, both positive and not so positive, in terms of how do we deal with minorities in the country that we want to integrate but could have some social and cultural differences.
We'll have more on that point in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Leo Michel. He's senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, from whom you just heard, and Benjamin Haddad. He's a research fellow in European and Transatlantic Affairs at the Hudson Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington as well. We're discussing the fallout from the recent terror attacks in Brussels. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Johnson Kamalu from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Well, back to you, Benjamin, because since Leo Michel brought up the point about how Muslim communities here in the United States are very well integrated, to what extent do you think Europe can learn from the United States or do better in terms of integrating these marginalized communities?
One of the changes is that all over Europe, and Molenbeek is probably the most extreme example of this, certain neighborhoods have been almost abandoned by public service to a certain extent, you know, with not the same access to education and economic opportunities, but also abandoned from other kinds of public service, such as the police, intelligence, security. And they've been, in certain cases, almost outsourced to community leaders, to Muslim leaders, thinking that this was a way to buy social peace, as some in Europe would say. I mean, clearly, Molenbeek is an example of this, where even the former mayor of Molenbeek has expressed regrets recently, saying, well, maybe he closed his eye too much to what was going on because he thought that was a way to be able to work with community leaders and let them take responsibility for certain neighborhoods. And this has led sometimes to an increase in radicalization and Salafism, with also a lot of foreign money from the Gulf coming through to fund certain radical mosques or programs there. I think the French have actually been doing a better job at this. I mean, if you take just the arrest of Abdelhamid Abaoud, who was one of the perpetrators of the November 13th attack, he was the brains behind it. He was hiding in Saint-Denis, and he was caught very quickly because the police was tipped off by a local citizen who had recognized him and saw that he was in an apartment next to hers, and she called the police. Abdeslam managed to hide for 4 months in the middle of Molenbeek, as I said earlier, with apparently no one calling the authorities. So it's clearly urgent to get more involved. Now, the identity debate at the heart of this, obviously, is what kind of leeway, how much can you accept in terms of expression of Islamic culture in these neighborhoods? And that's the debate that countries are going through. Obviously, Anglo-Saxon countries have tend to be much more the burqa, and there's a debate right now in France about wearing of the veil in universities. So it's always a tension between what you ask to the immigrant population, what kind of, you know, adaptation, assimilation do you demand from them to the hosting culture, and what kind of a compromise European nations are ready to do.
Well, turning to you, Leo Michel, in the few minutes we have left, we have to address the question of foreign fighters. And of course, we know that official estimates last year said that nearly 500 young Muslim residents in Belgium alone traveled to Syria or Iraq to join extremist groups, making it the European country with the highest number of foreign fighters per capita. again, we have a twin problem here. Mm-hmm. We have the festering conflict in Syria, which is a breeding ground in and of itself for extremism, whether it's through ISIS and its ideology, but also just the continued battle between the Bashar al-Assad regime, which in and of itself is, one could say, a regime that has committed war crimes, and just the two, one being the other side of the coin of the other, many say. While this persists, you're going to have more foreign fighters who are sympathetic to the cause. I mean, how do you see this playing out?
There is obviously a military dimension to combating terrorism. We see it manifested in different ways in Afghanistan, now in the Syrian and also in the Iraqi conflicts as well. But even if you speak to our military people, when the military looks at a strategy for combating terrorism, the military sees themselves as one or two parts of a 9 or 10 part comprehensive approach, if you will. The military role is conducting airstrikes and very limited special operations on the ground, and it's conducting training and capacity building for Iraqi forces and trying to engage with some allies, but not really under a NATO hat, to do similar things. But this is really only one part of the broader effort, because it comes back to some of the issues that you've mentioned. There are European-born, mainly men, but some women as well, who are traveling from Europe to fight in Iraq or in Syria, and some go back. Some certainly must go back disillusioned, but some are going back, apparently, under orders to mount attacks in Europe as well. That second problem can't be addressed by conducting strikes. And that is where all of the system that the EU is working on, and that involves tracking terrorist financing, trying to push the game a little bit upstream so we begin to address some of the root problems, to include some of these social problems that generate the breeding ground for terrorism.
Absolutely. And back to you, Benjamin Haddad, because military is only one approach of a multi-pronged approach that we need to solve this problem, how do you see the question of foreign fighters and the actual conflict that seems to be attracting them, that is Syria?
Clearly, as we said, it's a two-pronged effort. You have a homegrown terrorism in European countries. I mean, most of the perpetrators of the recent Paris attacks and Brussels attacks were French and Belgian citizens who grew up there, but then went to Syria to fight and came back. And a country like Belgium, notably, is confronting a considerable number, in terms of proportion of its population, of foreign fighters who come back. And it's still unclear, and maybe we will know more with the interrogation of Abdeslam, actually, because he's the first one who got caught for these two attacks. But the level of command and control coming from ISIS in Syria, from Raqqa or wherever, is still unclear. These fighters have met apparently in Syria, but to what extent these attacks have been coordinated, ordered, to what extent they are linked to ISIS being strong, or on the contrary, ISIS's territory shrinking and thus trying to displace the fight to Europe. I mean, analysts still disagree on this. But what we know for sure is that Syria and the rise of ISIS in Syria have been an inspiration, at least, of these fighters. And this is why it is also very important to take the fight there militarily speaking. Now, obviously, the only country that really has the military means to make a difference on the ground would be the United States, maybe leading a coalition of regional countries that could then promote a transition and the empowerment of local Sunnis in Syria and Iraq to fight back radical groups. The problem is that this administration has been extremely reluctant to get more involved in Syria and in the process, despite strong rhetoric, for example, on the issue of a political transition without Assad, which could have taken out the main reason for the rise of these groups in Syria. And when you go to Europe, there is clearly a lot of disillusion and a lot of disappointment over this administration handling of the Syrian issue, especially the case of the non-enforcement of the red line over the use of chemical weapons in 2013 by Bashar al-Assad's regime. So I don't see, unfortunately, in the last remaining months of the administration, a more robust position, militarily speaking. I think President Obama's approach is to take the long view that these attacks will happen, that there are setbacks, as he called it himself after the November attacks in Paris, and that we should progressively encroach on ISIS's territory in Syria and Iraq. I think the main problem of this approach is that obviously it's maybe fine for the United States, which is less directly connected to the conflict in terms of attacks and in terms of refugee flows as well, but it's approving a very direct challenge to European security. And as Louis-Michel said earlier, the consequence of this being a weakening of the transatlantic alliance, a weakening of America's foremost ally on the international stage.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.